Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, do you like to throw like dinner parties, put together like appetizers for things? Do you call yourself a foodie?
I am a foodie. I don't do a lot of dinner parties anymore, per se, but I do like to whip up a nice balsamic onion and feta or goat cheese pizza.
Yeah.
You know, just on the fly.
Oh, yeah.
Sprinkle some rosemary.
Goat cheese pizza is always so good. Like really goat cheese pizza with like grapes and rosemary. I love that.
Oh, yeah. Grapes. All right. Yeah. I know what I'm going to add now.
So these are very, you know, these are modern foods. These are, you know, we pretty much have everything in the world at our disposal.
Yeah. I was about to say, I should point out that the balsamic onions I use are from a grocery store chain that are frozen.
Oh, okay.
Which makes me being a foodie super easy, to your point.
Well, but even, you know, there are even some, even if you're not going to, even if you're going to use raw materials, you know, there's just so many at our disposal.
True.
So modern cuisine just encompasses everything. But have you ever attempted to cook with ancient methods or to prepare ancient recipes?
Have I churned my own butter?
Yeah.
Have I created a little hole in the ground in my backyard and just filled it full of hot coals? And
yeah. Grill up some
stuffed
mammoth
a pig
or
in there.
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
No.
Well, I don't think I have either. But it is a fascinating prospect. The idea of inviting people over, or just preparing this nice meal, setting the table, and then it's like nuts and bugs.
Nuts and bugs.
Yeah, nuts and bugs, which could be very, very. I'm not setting this up like, oh, this is gross, and the goat cheese pizza is great. The goat cheese pizza is great, but bugs and nuts are good too. I mean,
so are you saying that, like, this is the Pleistocene era dinner party?
Yeah, it's like the Pleistocene dinner party. We're kind of trying to imagine here. It would be a very different affair than what we're used to. As we try and understand what people ate in the past, it is kind of challenging because we don't always have the best kept records of what people ate, especially when you get back, you know, obviously into prehistoric times. It's called prehistoric because there's not really any recorded history. You have to depend on fossil records, you know, looking at the actual teeth of our ancestors and seeing what they were capable of eating.
Yeah. And when we looked at Neanderthals, we actually, or Neanderthal, as they're called, we actually found that meat really wasn't as present in their diet as people thought.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was a lot more vegetable matter and so on and so forth. And that meat as a main source of protein is sort of a myth because it's very obvious that bones would subsist better than vegetable matter, right?
Yeah. I mean, you have to keep in mind, catching something to eat is kind of a challenging affair. Like, if you had to go catch an animal and eat it right now, I mean, not counting pets, not counting squirrels that are so used to the presence of humans that you could go and grab one with your hand.
Yeah.
You know, in an actual prehistoric environment where everything is fearful of everything else, yeah, it's a lot harder to actually go out and catch that much meat.
Right. I would be toast. And I think most of us would be toast if we had to go out and actually get our, except for Mark Zuckerberg, of course.
Yeah. But then also speaking of toasting, I mean, that's another thing too. Since cooking, which we'll get to in a lot in a few minutes, can be used as a means of preserving meat. That's mm-hmm. the thing too. It's like, say you're a, you know, prehistoric tribesman, you bring down some sort of large animal. Well, get eating, because you only have so much time before that meat is spoiled in a warm environment.
Right, and hopefully you've got a salt flat nearby, right, so you can at least preserve some of it, if you know the methods, if the methods have been taught to you, if there's enough language at this point to communicate this.
Yeah, there was the movie about the kid who goes out into the wilderness to survive?
Oh, this is John Krakow. Book, right? It was based off of that. I cannot remember. Into the Woods or something.
Into the Wild.
Into the Wild.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, like there's a scene in that where he kills a large animal and he's looking to try and, you know, preserve the meat as fast as possible, and it just ends up failing because it's a huge undertaking, mm-hmm. especially if you as a people have not developed the technology to do it yet.
Yeah. Well, and let's do a quick timeline if people will allow us such an indulgence of what we're looking at when we talk about these kinds of foods.
Yeah.
Before we became an agrarian culture, we're talking actually a much longer, like 20,000 plus years ago, you're really looking at food sources such as very basic water, ice, salt. Again, if you've got a salt bed handy, fish, mushrooms, eggs, right? So you could probably creep up to a little nest and grab some eggs.
Easy pickings.
Some grains. And, of course, insects.
Yes.
Really important. This is called entomophagy, right? When you eat insects, it's a great source of protein.
Yeah, because they're everywhere. They're just everywhere. And they're so easy to catch. Generally, you're not going to have to fight for your life to grab, you know, a nice juicy grub to eat.
Yeah.
You just got to know where to dig, know where to tap.
Right. And if you are in the West, that probably sounds weird, but obviously in some Eastern cultures, this is, you know, street food for people. It still exists.
Yeah. It's still traditional food in many parts of Asia and Africa. And, you know, you can go on the streets of Bangkok and get fried insects.
And supposedly it's delicious.
Yeah. I didn't get to try it when I was there. There was all sorts of street food, but we didn't actually get to see the insect car.
Because
I
would have tried. There's a reason to go back.
Yeah, there's totally a reason to go back.
Yeah. And then you've got the sort of post-agrarian 15,000 years ago or so. You've got sheep, wheat, cherries, and almonds.
Yeah, so, this is after we're domesticating animals. Yeah. We're growing. We actually have early agriculture, so we're growing up some plants we're going to use. We've got animals that we are controlling, and they're not going anywhere, and we can kill and eat them at our whim.
Yeah, but still, we're talking about sheep here. We're not talking about cows or pigs or anything else.
Right.
I mean, it's still very limited. And then
the sheep were the first to get pulled in, right?
They were.
Yeah, they're kind of dumb.
Sorry, guys. But then, 7,000 BC, beer and wine.
Oh, yes.
Yep, fermentation of fruit and hops. And then you start to see cattle domestication in a very real way. And then in 6,000 BC, you've got maize, tortillas, honey, chickpeas. 5,000 BC, milk, yogurt. 3,600 BC, popcorn, which just, you know.
that was the big invention that year.
And they had little carts out there, and they had the little red and white striped buckets.
Yeah.
Yep. And then look at this. Okay, this is interesting. So you've got popcorn, 3,600 BC, 3,000 BC, spices starting to be used. And then 500 BC, skip forward, sausage.
Wow. Okay.
And then this is interesting. Obviously, this is a highly selected list. There's a ton of stuff that we could go on forever, and it would be like reading the telephone book, and would be highly unpleasant. But the reason I wanted to point some of these out is because as you go, as you come more toward the present, you see more and more processing of food. So 9th century coffee and cod, because they go so well together. Mm-hmm. 11th century corned beef and cider. 15th century jellies, jams, and preserves. And then 1769 tofu in America. 1824, A1 steak sauce, 1879, saccharin, and then we've got Crisco in 1911, Vegemite 1922, 1937, the halcyon of processed foods, Spam.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So what are we seeing? I mean, what we're seeing here is just our ability to manipulate food more and more throughout the centuries.
To the point where it becomes increasingly more like this sci-fi idea of like, enjoy some food cubes, you know, where it just sort of comes out and it doesn't even look anything like a creature or a plant. And maybe never was a creature.
No, no. But I think it's important to sort of talk about this just in the context of, I mean, how do we get from, you know, spearing insects and trying to figure out whether or not a tuber was edible or inedible to getting to this spam part.
Yeah, because as a basic, like, one, like, picture yourself in the woods. Like, I've been doing this a little recently as we've been looking into these food topics. And I guess maybe I've been outside a little more in the last year. And you know, like looking around in a wilderness situation, especially here in Georgia, you look around and you're like, wow, what if I just suddenly had to survive right now? Just on my, you know, just had to forage to see what I could, you know, I would be dead, you know, before the end of the day, probably.
But
you know, as a wanderer, and that's the thing too, as humans spread throughout the world and found new homes, they had to be able to find these things, and some areas were more conducive to it than others. But basically, early humans, you know, you're going around, you're looking for berries, you're looking for nuts, you're looking for fungus, you're looking for water sources.
Yes.
And the thing is that all of these can be poisoned if you don't know what you're looking for. Some berries, they may be, one's really red and it's really good to eat. The other's red and will kill you in a heartbeat. Funguses, obviously, some are going to be delicious. Some are going to make you see the devil, and some are going to kill you dead. Water sources, some are going to be clean and wonderful. Some are going to clean you out.
Well, this is when it becomes really important, this whole trial and error process,
right,
and really communicating, you know, among your tribe or whatever the situation is, like, hey, do not pick this type of mushroom. Bad things happen. It's happened to me. I survived it, or someone didn't survive it. So, you know,
the holy man. He's like, you have to give me those mushrooms, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just save those for me.
But so how do you do trial and error when you're dealing with potentially lethal consequences? I mean, especially it's like, just say, even if it's just a thing where you get dysentery, like today, dysentery is a lot more treatable, you know, especially in the, more modern Western civilizations. But back then, it's like dysentery could be, until very recently, dysentery was a death sentence in many places, and it still is in many places.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of whether or not something might be poisonous, I mean, there are going to be some clues right off the bat. You know, if you bring it up to your lips, does it begin to sting? If you put it in your mouth, do you go into anaphylactic shock?
Right.
These sort of things that might be able to sort of head you off from death before, you know, you actually get there by consuming it. So there are some clues that it would give you. But again, the trying to orally tell this information is really important. And then later, as an agrarian society with domestication of dogs, it becomes a lot easier.
Oh, because dogs, of course, will eat anything.
They will eat anything. Yeah. You throw them that, say, hey, check that out. Maybe you have 20 dogs and you have one to spare. It's an easy way to figure out whether or not something is edible or inedible.
Yeah. It's like a dog could eat it and not die. So it must be good for dinner. That's setting the bar kind of low, I think, but you know, it's better than nothing.
Yeah.
And of course, people end up developing all these different myths and stories. You end up with this oral history to share with your people that lets you just, you know, kind of like a memorization sheet of what you can eat and what you can't, which is not unlike the memory palace.
That's what I was just thinking too. Yeah.
Instead of just trying to remember, all right, this red berry will kill you and this one is pretty delicious, you create a story about it and then it'll sink in a lot more.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, how do we teach our kids right now to avoid things? We give them scary, like, you know, Grimm's fairy tales, you know, watch out for the witch. I mean, you know, it's all a little bit, you know, in the same manner, I suppose.
Yeah.
But there you go. I mean, you are foraging, you're giving your food scraps to the dogs, and then on top of that, you're probably giving them something new that you're interested in finding out whether or not you want to eat. And all of this starts to evolve into, you know, this tide of food that becomes available to us and that we cultivate. But the big, big thing here, obviously, is fire.
Right. Yeah, and it's really difficult to figure out when we first began using fire deliberately. You look at some of these estimates, and you can see some people say like Asia 500 BC. Other estimates are in Africa, even further in the past. In it just kind of depends on which one you go with. And, you know, it's hard to figure out exactly when then, you know, because obviously you're keeping a fire.
Mm-hmm.
You might use the fire to obviously to keep warm, to scare away animals, eventually to craft tools. But at what point do you discover, hey, if I take this piece of meat and accidentally drop it in the fire, then when it comes back out, it has a different taste, it has a different consistency.
Right. Or if I take this potato, which mm-hmm. was inedible, and I cook it, then all of a sudden I have something that's really nutritious,
right?
That I can now eat. So, I mean,
because that's the thing about fire; it doesn't just. I mean, it has several. The way it changes the property of a food, it does so in several different ways. I mean, obviously, if you cook meat thoroughly,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to worry as much about like parasites.
Right,
that's just a small thing. You don't have to worry about getting sick as much from it. Then the taste is going to be in many ways better. And then also you're going to be able to digest it easier. It's going to bring
up
protein.
That's a huge part of that, I believe, that the digestion part, because we were talking about this a little bit that, you know, back in the day, obviously there was no plumbing. So you would not want to put yourself at risk for just fooling around with a certain food to see whether or not you could eat it, because, you know, who wants to be doubled over in a cave with diarrhea?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you will be shunned.
Yeah, and there are not that many caves. Why are you doing it in the cave?
Yeah, go outside.
Come on, Lizzie.
I know it's snowing, but
it's like if we suddenly had a magic sauce that you could pour over rocks and make them edible. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's kind of like that's the thing. It's like being able to cook things suddenly makes things that you could not eat before edible. It opens up the culinary world a little larger, and in that way. Ensures your survival a little more.
Yeah, and there is no question that this gave us the upper hand as a species.
And that's the important thing to realize too about these early societies, well, even modern society, food is survival.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as much as, you know, especially in privileged portions of the world, we get wrapped up in food as enjoyment and food as this recreation and this thing that we love, but it's survival. I mean, obviously, and that's an outrageous overstatement of the obvious, but like most outrageous overstatements of the obvious, we do so because you really have to drive home a point that we often overlook. You know, this was the key to so many of the roots of modern cuisine, was that we had to figure out ways to survive. We had to figure out ways to eat things that we couldn't eat previously.
Right.
And eat things tomorrow that we would otherwise have to eat all of it today.
Well, yeah, even until the Industrial Revolution, it was pretty much touch and go when it came to getting the right amount of food and protein and surviving, right?
Right.
I mean, little kids, you know, babies often would perish because they didn't have enough food, or their parents didn't have enough food, or
mm-hmm.
obviously disease was pretty rampant as well. So anyway, until we stabilized enough of society, we really didn't take it as we do today. It's like, oh, okay, I'm just going to sit down and have myself a meal here. Whether or not it's in a restaurant, or I just pull something out of my freezer and it happens to be balsamic onions, which are delicious.
So yeah, preservation of food. This is key. Well, we alluded to this earlier. Like if you heat a meat, if you cook it right, it can last longer. Like
right.
The classic example of this is beef jerky. You know, some people may just think, oh, beef jerky is delicious because I can buy it at a truck stop and eat it while I'm driving. Well, you know, and beef jerky can be really good if you're into that sort of thing. But it's an example of meat that's preserved. I mean, it's
right,
like
dried.
It's dried out. It can last longer. It's not going to rot and make you sick. And we see several different food preservation techniques that were essential early on, because especially when you're dealing with harsh winters. You've got to, I mean, it's like the grasshopper and the ant, right? The ant stores his food away and is therefore able to survive the winter. The grasshopper doesn't and dies during the winter. So we had to learn to be ants, pretty early on, which is taking something delicious now and save it for the winter, even if it's going to be a little disgusting come winter.
Oh yeah. You have a really good example of that. Bag of disgustingness.
Yes.
I mean, to me, not to this culture.
Yeah. We kind of, some of these are basically their survival foods. They're things that, and you see a lot of these in more extreme environments, such as Greenland,
mm-hmm.
where we have this thing called kiviak, which we're going to get to right after this quick break.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
All right, kiviak, lay it on me.
Yeah, okay. So, happens in Greenland. All right. So every year, these little birds, baby birds.
Cute, I must say.
Yeah, very cute little guys. You know, they're all out. They're all just swarming all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great time to eat little birds because they're everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And they have this great way of catching them. They develop this, it's like this big sort of slingshot net. Like a picture of like a giant butterfly net.
And I was thinking like Dr. Seussian net.
Yeah, it's very Seussian.
Yeah.
And, they sling that thing around. And if you've, there's the Discovery BBC co-production Human Planet has some excellent footage of this in their episode about the Arctic. But they sling this, this net around and they catch these birds. And like in a day, they'll just catch hundreds of these things and they'll catch them and they'll snap their little necks, put them in a bag, and then they'll take them back home. Now, what are they doing when they get home? Do they fry them up?
No,
because this is not food for now. This is because now's a great.
What are you going to do with 500 auks?
Yeah. You can't eat them. You can't eat them all now. It's impossible.
Right.
And you are worrying about surviving later. But you also can't just pile them in, you know, a corner of your house, or they're going to rot. Other things are going to eat. They're not going to be food come winter. So they actually take a page from the book of the Arctic fox, which pretty much all foxes will do this. This is why they talk about like a fox getting into a hen house. It'll just kill all the chickens.
Yeah.
Because the fox's way is to like, well, there's all this food now. I'm going to kill it all and I'm going to bury it. I'm going to hide it. And then I'll come back and eat it when it's nice and nasty later on during the winter. So it's the same principle. But instead of just burying it under a rock, they take the birds. And they stuff them, again, by the hundreds, into a big seal skin. And then they seal it. No pun intended.
Mm-hmm.
And then they jump on it, get all the air out of it. They
literally are jumping on this right after, and they've sewn the top, right?
Yeah. And they put, I think it's like seal fat on it. To help keep it sealed and to keep flies away from it. Then they put some big rocks over it to keep anything from digging it up and to get the rest of the air out of it. And then they leave it for months. And then when they come back to it, once food is a little more scarce and they need to start getting into the survival food, all these little birds have fermented. All right.
Yummy.
Yeah. So they say the aroma is like a really pungent cheese.
Yeah. And was it Richard Attenborough who,
was
narrating
John
that?
Hurt.
John Hurt.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Huh. Okay. Totally different voices.
Yeah.
But it, I think I remember it saying that it's ready when it stings the nostrils.
Yes.
Which I thought, well, wow, that is something I want to eat right there.
Yeah. When I was watching this episode with my wife for the first time, we were like, oh my goodness, they're, you know, watching them get these out. And we're like, please cook those birds. Please cook those birds. And they don't. They just tear into them. And it's a delicacy.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to focus too much on like, oh, this is gross food because, This is
what's gross to someone else is great to someone else.
Yeah, and it's a delicacy to these guys, and it could easily be a delicacy to us if we had developed a taste for it.
Right.
That being said, I find it really interesting because I love the survival food aspect of it, but I'm also really intrigued by its kind of grossness and what it really tells us about food preservation, about how important it is. There are a few other really cool examples of survival food from I believe Iceland. And guy I know by the name of Andy works for a gaming company that's headquartered in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a chance to try several of these. So I asked him, I shot him an email and was like, hey, what were some of the more interesting survival foods that you got to try? Because in Iceland now you don't need to eat these things, but
right.
They're part of the culture and they're something you kind of celebrate. He said that there is a shark called it's a pea shark, and it's fermented. It's called a hackerel, so it's kind of like the same principle. But he said it's not that bad if you take it with a shot of liquor.
See, that's the whole point right there. I think. Yeah.
And then he said that the worst though was a cold sour ram testicle loaf called the Hrutsprunger, and he says it's worse than it sounds, and it sounds terrible.
Ram testicle loaf.
Yeah.
Okay.
He said the fish jerky was very good, and he said that the pickled whale blubber was actually fairly good too. So some of these things sound kind of gross, but apparently they're not that bad. Some of them sound kind of gross and are kind of gross, at least to the Western palate. But again, these are harsh environments, harsh winters.
Right.
So you got to take what you have, you got to store it away, and then be able to get it out and eat it When times get rough.
Well, and I thought this was interesting. This is from Cooking in Ancient Civilizations by Kathy Kaufman. And she says, quote, "For thousands of years, the survival and power of a tribe or country depended on its stock and grain. Harvesting, processing, and storing grain stocks was of huge importance, and war was declared only after harvest." And one of the earliest records of large-scale food preserving was in ancient Egypt, as we know, where it was really important to have an adequate stock of dried grain. And as you know, the Nile would flood seasonally, so they had these big silos where they would store it. And records from 2600 BC show that the annual flooding of the Nile produced surpluses of grain that were stored and kept to feed builders of irrigation schemes and pyramid tombs. The Great Pyramid of Cheops at Giza was built around 2900 BC by slaves fed with stores of grain and chickpeas, onions, and garlic.
Yeah. It's the ultimate survival food because it's grain. It can be kept and then it can be turned into bread or porridge or what have you later on.
Yeah.
And it becomes in early societies, but really modern societies too, like grain is power. Grain is survival and bread is essential, especially in an urban environment. I mean, it becomes almost a currency.
Yeah, and I think it's very telling that, you know, war would sort of take a break during harvest.
Yeah.
Because, you know, why would you disturb one of the most plentiful, bounteous times of food available to you? I mean, you would be wiping out your civilization.
Yeah, and I've also there are different arguments, of course, about, you know, like how war really got started in human civilization, but there is the argument that you really didn't have war per se until we had reached the point as an agrarian culture where we could have these silos of grain, where we could have
where something was worth taking.
Yeah, we had a surplus of essential materials in the form of grain.
It's interesting too, just on a side note, that Costa Rica doesn't have any sort of army.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And what I love about that is their whole thing is, well, if we don't have something, some sort of central government that has, you know, munitions and this power structure here, then nobody really wants to take us over.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you wanted to take over Costa Rica, I guess it's like we really like, you know, jungles.
Yeah. You want to take over our sloths? They're high maintenance.
Yeah. That's one really cool thing about Costa Rica for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, so you'd have to, you know, you have these things, like you said, you've got these stockpiles that all of a sudden become very interesting to other tribes or cultures to take over.
Yeah. It's interesting thinking about like grain as survival food and grain is the thing you store away now for food later. I feel like in the office here at How Stuff Works, I think everybody kind of has like a survival food stored in their desk.
It's true.
Like today I managed to leave without bringing my lunch with me. I've got a like noodle bowl in my desk, which is like, you know, a little plastic bowl with stuff that looks like dust in the bottom of it. And then you add water and voila,
I've got one
it becomes
too.
A soup. Yeah.
That's funny. I have that and I have mac and cheese and then I have some cocoa from when it was cold, cold for like 4 days in the winter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
You
see people pulling out oatmeal packs too. You
know? Yes. Yeah. So, that's a big thing throughout the day too, not just for breakfast.
Not enough pickled fish. Come on.
Yeah. Wheat pickled herring.
Yeah.
Where is it?
back to food preservation for just a moment.
Yeah.
Other techniques include pickling, you know, preserving it in a vinegar or some sort of a harsh fluid. Eventually we get to the point where we can bottle things and can things. But that really comes much later. The technology for that actually during, Napoleonic times really gets interesting.
Right. This was, for French troops, right? In an effort to try to preserve food.
Right. There was a man by the name of Appert, A-P-P-E-R-T.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have to share this bit from James Burke's Connections. James Burke is he's covered a lot about the history of science. And he's big on like comparing like, you know, sort of like these different little paths through technology that lead from something simple to something highly advanced and earth-shattering. He says here, Appert's idea was to preserve food. The container for his first attempts was the champagne bottle. He had handled these bottles often during his earlier years, and as he said, "The form of the champagne bottle is most convenient. It is the handsomest, as well as the strongest, and is of the best shape for packing up." So he placed the food.
That's nice.
Yeah. He placed the food to be preserved in the bottles, and he sealed it with a cork. And, as they were in the wine business, by wire cages. So eventually we learn how to to do this a little better with cans. But
yeah,
I've actually seen footage of one of these bottles, and it looks kind of gross because it's like ancient soup.
Yeah, why is that so unappetizing?
I don't know. But this guy was a big, you know, he was like, this is the perfect way. He was envisioning a future where, like, anytime you wanted to have dinner and you didn't have anything prepared, well, you go down to the wine cellar. You get yourself a bottle of wine, a bottle of soup, and you come up and have something.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay, that's not bad. Bottle of wine, a bottle of soup. That was a really bad Billy Joel joke. Sorry. And then you have pasteurization, too, which starts in the late 1800s, which, again, helps us to, you know, pasteurize milk, juices, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Makes us a much more portable society as well.
Yeah.
And freeze-drying space missions, right?
Exactly, yeah. Even more techniques where we can take the food of today and make it available for consumption later on.
Yeah, and then don't forget nitrates and cured meats, talking hot dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is kind of a smorgasbord, if you will, a buffet table of some ancient...
A
poo-poo platter of ancient and not-so-ancient food techniques about the evolution of food and some of the science of food, which we're going to get into more detail in some upcoming episodes. It's all really fascinating because, like I say, the story of food is the story of humans. It's the story of science and technology, and so it's kind of neat to sort of go back and sort of lay the groundwork and briefly discuss some of the trends in the evolution of food.
Yeah, like how we went from eating insects for basic survival to paying $500 for a hamburger in, you know, one of the toniest restaurants in New York City.
Yeah,
I'm not kidding. Isn't there like a $500 hamburger?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe gold flecks on it.
I think I saw that on it's kind of a gimmick at some place.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you actually order the hamburger, they have to like send a guy out to get the materials for it. And, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. All right. We've got some listener mail. So let's get that.
Yes. Let's get out of food and let's get into math. We recently did Math, Music, and Mayhem, another one of our math related episodes. And we had a listener by the name of Graham from Scotland, and he wrote in and said, as a PhD candidate in physics, I was delighted to see your recent math-related podcast. Whilst these were very interesting, I found your attitudes in the introduction disappointing. For some reason, however, it is acceptable to admit to being bad at maths, and I believe that your comments serve only to reinforce that this idea is acceptable. I don't expect everyone to have enthusiasm for every topic, but I can't say I've ever heard you confess to disliking a subject in the preface to another podcast.
So I was so saddened by this because I thought, oh my gosh, that's definitely not what we were trying to put out there. I think if anything, we were sort of being apologetic in our lack of mathleteness. So Graham, I hope that you understand that that we absolutely worship at the math altar. If anything, we wish we were a lot better at, but unfortunately there are a lot of people who you know, with journalism degrees or English degrees like ourselves that are in the same boat, and we certainly have dedicated time to math related subjects because we think it's so interesting.
I guess we were sort of trying to disarm the non-math listeners in a way to say like, hey,
don't run,
we're not going to really get heavy into math because we're not really heavy math people, but math is still really amazing and let's show you why.
Personally, it's a tragedy, the great tragedy of my life that I didn't have more of it. The greatest tragedy of my life.
Yeah. Where would you be if you'd been more? You'd be ruling this place by now.
Oh, yeah. I'd be in the ether.
But anyway, I still think Graham makes a valid comment here, and I'm happy that we could mention this in the podcast and to sort of address this, just in case anyone else was wondering. It's like, why do they not like math all that much? No, we like math, but we do realize our limitations.
Yes.
And as Dirty Harry said, a man has got to know his limitations.
That's the truth. So thank you, Graham from Scotland. And since we just did a food podcast, I would love to recite Ode to a Haggis, but I don't know it by heart.
Yeah. Who's that by?
Robert Burns, I believe.
Really? Oh, I guess I have heard of Ode to a Haggis.
Yeah.
All right, well, here's another one related to math. This is from listener Paul. Paul writes in and says, greetings. Just got done listening to Math, Music, and Mayhem. You mentioned Brian May's physics background, and it reminded me that another of my favorite bands is also very mathematical, Tool. One great example of this is the song Lateralis, which makes a lot of use of Fibonacci sequence. Here is a link to a video that explains it, and he's sent this link, and I actually just put this up on Facebook. Of course, it'll be buried by the time this comes. Well, you can look it up. Just look up Tool and Fibonacci. And we actually have an article on How Stuff Works about Fibonacci numbers if you're not really sure what they
written
are.
Written by you. It's quite lovely.
Oh, yes. I think it was written by me. But yep. So long ago that I've forgotten most of the things about it. But yeah, this is the second listener who's mentioned Tool, who I used to listen to an awful lot, and I never really tied in, made connections with most of the number stuff. But apparently there is, now that I think about it, there are a number of tracks that allude to equations, if you will. So, I don't know. But we've received a lot of good feedback from people based on that podcast with other musicians that are also mathematicians or have some sort of math or science background. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting. There were a few that I was not aware of.
I think it confirmed our suspicions.
Yeah.
So, anecdotally, at least, the connection there.
So if you have anything you would like to share with us, you can check out that Facebook and Twitter page that I alluded to. We are Blow the Mind on both of those.
And you can send us an email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join How Stuff Works staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.